imagination could often be a powerfully effective aid to his utilitarian activities. No agreement can ever be reached between men of his sort and those who obey the ideal within them which urges them to strip themselves bare of such advantages, so that they may seek only to realize that ideal, similar in that respect to the painters, the writers who renounce their virtuosity, the artistic peoples who modernize themselves, warrior peoples who take the initiative in a move for universal disarmament, absolute governments which turn democratic and repeal their harsh laws, though as often as not the sequel fails to reward their noble effort. For the men lose their talent, the nations their secular predominance. Pacifism often multiplies wars and indulgence criminality. If Saint-Loup's efforts towards sincerity and emancipation were only to be commended as most noble, to judge by their visible result, one could still be thankful that they had failed to bear fruit in Monsieur de Charlus, who had transferred to his own home much of the admirable panelling from the Guermantes house, instead of substituting, like his nephew, a modern style of decoration, employing Le Bourg or Guillaumin. It was nonetheless true that Monsieur de Charlus's ideal was highly artificial. And if the epithet can be applied to the word ideal, as much social as artistic. In certain women of great beauty and rare culture, whose ancestresses 2 centuries earlier had shared in all the glory and grace of the old order, he found a distinction which made him take pleasure only in their society. And no doubt the admiration for them which he had protested was sincere, but countless reminiscences, historical and artistic, called forth by their names, entered into and formed a great part of it, just as suggestions of classical antiquity are one of the reasons for the pleasure which a book lover finds in reading an ode of Horace that is perhaps inferior to poems of our own day, which would leave the same book lover cold. Any of these women by the side of a pretty commoner was for him what are, hanging beside a contemporary canvas representing a procession or a wedding, those old pictures the history of which we know, from the Pope or King who ordered them, through the hands of people whose acquisition of them by gift, purchase, conquest, or inheritance recalls to us some event, or at least some alliance of historic interest, and consequently some knowledge that we ourselves have acquired, gives it a fresh utility, increases our sense of the richness of the possessions of our memory or of our erudition. Monsieur de Charlus might be thankful that a prejudice similar to his own, by preventing these several great ladies from mixing with women whose blood was less pure, presented them for his veneration unspoiled, in their unaltered nobility, like an 18th-century house front supported on its flat columns of pink marble in which the passage of time has wrought no change. Monsieur de Charlus praised the true nobility of mind and heart which characterized these women, playing upon the word in a double sense, by which he himself was taken in, and in which lay the falsehood of this bastard conception, of this medley of aristocracy, generosity and art, but also its seductiveness, dangerous to people like my grandmother, to whom the less refined but more innocent prejudice of a nobleman who cared only about quarterings and took no thought for anything besides would have appeared too silly for words, whereas she was defenceless as soon as the thing presented itself under the externals of a mental superiority. So much so, indeed, that she regarded princes as enviable above all other men, because they were able to have a La Bruyère, a Fénelon, as their tutors. Outside the Grand Hotel, the 3 Guermantes left us. They were going to luncheon with the Princesse de Luxembourg. While my grandmother was saying goodbye to Madame de Villeparisis and Saint-Loup to my grandmother, Monsieur de Charlus, who so far had not uttered a word to me, drew back a little way from the group, and when he reached my side, said, "I shall be taking tea this evening after dinner in my Aunt Villeparisis's room. I hope that you'll give me the pleasure of seeing you there, and your grandmother." With which he rejoined the Marquise. Although it was Sunday, there were no more carriages waiting outside the hotel now than at the beginning of the season. The solicitor's wife, in particular, had decided that it was not worth the expense of hiring one every time, simply because she was not going to the compromers, and contented herself with staying in her room. "Is Madame Blondet not well?" her husband was asked. "We haven't seen her all day." "Oh, she has a slight headache. It's the heat. There's thunder coming. The least thing upsets her, but I expect you'll see her this evening. I've told her she ought to come down. It can't do her any harm." I had supposed that in thus inviting us to take tea with his aunt, whom I never doubted that he would have warned that we were coming, Monsieur de Charlus wished to make amends for the impoliteness which he'd shown me during our walk that morning. But when, on our entering Madame de Villeparisis's room, I attempted to greet her nephew, even although I walked right round him, while in shrill accents he was telling a somewhat spiteful story about one of his relatives, I did not succeed in catching his eye. I decided to say good evening to him, and fairly loud, to warn him of my presence, but I realized that he had observed it. For before ever a word had passed my lips, just as I began to bow to him, I saw his two fingers stretched out for me to shake, without his having turned to look at me, or pause in his story. He had evidently seen me, without letting it appear that he had, and I noticed then that his eyes, which were never fixed on the person to whom he was speaking, strayed perpetually in all directions, like those of certain animals when they're frightened, or those of street hawkers who, while they are bawling their patter and displaying their illicit merchandise, keep a sharp lookout, though without turning their heads, on the different points of the horizon from any of which may appear suddenly the police. At the same time, I was a little surprised to find that Madame de Villeparisis, while glad to see us, did not seem to have been expecting us. And I was still more surprised to hear Monsieur de Charlus say to my grandmother,
"Ah, that was a capital idea of yours to come and pay us a visit. Charming of them, is it not, my dear aunt?"
No doubt he had noticed his aunt's surprise at our entry, and thought, as a man accustomed to set the tone, to strike the right note, that it would be enough to transform that surprise into joy, were he to show that he himself felt it, that it was indeed the feeling which our arrival there ought to have prompted. In which he calculated wisely. For Madame de Villeparisis, who had a high opinion of her nephew, and knew how difficult it was to please him, appeared suddenly to have found new attractions in my grandmother, and continued to make much of her. But I failed to understand how Monsieur de Charlus could, in the space of a few hours, have forgotten the invitation, so curt, but apparently so intentional, so premeditated, which he had addressed to me that same morning. Or why he called a capital idea on my grandmother's part an idea that had been entirely his own. With a scruple of accuracy which I retained until I had reached the age at which I realized that it is not by asking him questions that one learns the truth of what another man has had in his mind, and that the risk of a misunderstanding which will probably pass unobserved is less than that which may come from a purblind insistence. "But, sir," I reminded him, "you remember, surely, that it was you who asked me if we would come in this evening?" Not a sound, not a movement betrayed that Monsieur de Charlus had so much as heard my question. Seeing which, I repeated it like a diplomat, or like young men after a misunderstanding, who endeavour with untiring and unrewarded zeal to obtain an explanation which their adversary is determined not to give them. Still, Monsieur de Charlus answered me not a word. I seemed to see, hovering upon his lips, the smile of those who from a great height pass judgment on the characters and breeding of their inferiors. Since he refused to give any explanation, I tried to provide one for myself, but succeeded only in hesitating between several, none of which could be the right one. Perhaps he did not remember, or perhaps it was I who had failed to understand what he'd said to me that morning. More probably, in his pride, he did not wish to appear to have sought to attract people whom he despised, and preferred to cast upon them the responsibility for their intrusion. But then, if he despised us, why had he been so anxious that we should come, or rather that my grandmother should come? For of the two of us it was to her alone that he spoke that evening, and never once to me. Talking with the utmost animation to her, as also to Madame de Villeparisis, hiding, so to speak, behind them, as though he were seated at the back of a theatre box, he contented himself, turning from them every now and then the exploring gaze of his penetrating eyes, with fastening it on my face with the same gravity, the same air of preoccupation, as if my face had been a manuscript difficult to decipher. No doubt, if he had not had those eyes, the face of Monsieur de Charlus would have been similar to the faces of many good-looking men. And when Saint-Loup, speaking to me of various other Guermantes on a later occasion, said, "Gad, they've not got that thoroughbred air of being gentlemen to their fingertips that Uncle Palamed has," confirming my suspicion that a thoroughbred air and aristocratic distinction were not anything mysterious and new, but consisted in elements which I had recognized without difficulty and without receiving any particular impression from them, I was to feel that another of my illusions had been shattered. But that face, to which a faint layer of powder gave almost the appearance of a face on the stage, in vain might Monsieur de Charlus hermetically seal its expression. His eyes were like two crevices, two loopholes which alone he had failed to stop, and through which, according to where one stood or sat in relation to him, one felt suddenly flash across one the glow of some internal engine, which seemed to offer no reassurance even to him, who, without being altogether master of it, must carry it inside him, at an unstable equilibrium, and always on the point of explosion. And the circumspect and unceasingly restless expression of those eyes, with all the signs of exhaustion which, extending from them to a pair of dark rings quite low down upon his cheeks, were stamped on his face, however carefully he might compose and regulate it, made one think of some incognito, some disguise assumed by a powerful man in danger, or merely by a dangerous, but tragic, person. I should have liked to divine what was this secret, which other men did not carry in their breasts, and which had already made Monsieur de Charlus's gaze so enigmatic to me when I had seen him that morning outside the casino. But with what I now knew of his family, I could no longer believe that they were the eyes of a thief, nor, after what I had heard of his conversation, could I say that they were those of a madman. If he was cold with me while making himself agreeable to my grandmother, that arose perhaps not from a personal antipathy, for generally speaking, just as he was kindly disposed towards women, of whose faults he used to speak without, as a rule, any narrowing of the broadest tolerance, so he showed with regard to men, and especially young men, a hatred so violent as to suggest that of certain extreme misogynists for women. Two or three carpet knights, relatives or intimate friends of Saint-Loup, who happened to mention their names, Monsieur de Charlus, with an almost ferocious expression, in sharp contrast to his usual coldness, called "little cads." I gathered that the particular fault which he found in the young men of the period was their extreme effeminacy.
"They're absolute women," he said with scorn.
But what life would not have appeared effeminate beside that which he expected a man to lead and never found energetic or virile enough? He himself, when he walked across country, after long hours on the road, would plunge his heated body into frozen streams. He would not even allow a man to wear a single ring. But this profession of virility did not prevent his having also the most delicate sensibilities. When Madame de Villeparisis asked him to describe to my grandmother some country house in which Madame de Sévigné had stayed, adding that she could not help feeling that there was something rather literary about that lady's distress at being parted from that tiresome Madame de Grignan.
"On the contrary," he retorted, "I can think of nothing more true. Besides, it was a time in which feelings of that sort were thoroughly understood. The inhabitant of La Fontaine's monomotapa, running to see his friend who had appeared to him in a dream and had looked sad, the pigeon finding that the greatest of evils is the absence of the other pigeon, seemed to you, perhaps, my dear aunt, as exaggerated as Madame de Sévigné's impatience for the moment when she will be alone with her daughter. It is so fine what she says when she leaves her. This parting gives a pain to my soul, which I feel like an ache in my body. In absence one is liberal with the hours. One anticipates a time for which one is longing."
My grandmother was in ecstasies at hearing the letters thus spoken of, exactly as she would have spoken of them herself. She was astonished that a man could understand them so thoroughly. She found in Monsieur de Charlus a delicacy, a sensibility, that were quite feminine. We said to each other afterwards, when we were by ourselves and began to discuss him together, that he must have come under the strong influence of a woman, his mother, or in later life his daughter, if he had any children. A mistress, perhaps, I thought to myself, remembering the influence that Saint Louis seemed to have had over him, which enabled me to realize the point to which men can be refined by the women with whom they live.
"Once she was with her daughter, she had probably nothing to say to her," put in Madame de Villeparisis. "Most certainly she had. If it was only what she calls things so slight that nobody else would notice them but you and me. And anyhow, she was with her, and La Bruyère tells us that that is everything. To be with the people one loves, to speak to them, not to speak to them, it is all the same. He is right. That is the only form of happiness," added Monsieur de Charlus in a mournful voice. "And that happiness, alas, life is so ill-arranged that one very rarely tastes it. Madame de Sévigné was, after all, less to be pitied than most of us. She spent a great part of her life with the person whom she loved."
"You forget that it was not love in her case. The person was her daughter."
"But what matters in life is not whom or what one loves," he went on in a judicial, peremptory, almost a cutting tone. "It is the fact of loving. What Madame de Sévigné felt for her daughter has a far better claim to rank with the passion that Racine described in Andromaque or Phèdre than the commonplace relations young Sévigné had with his mistresses. It's the same with a mystic's love for his god. The hard and fast lines with which we circumscribe love arise solely from our complete ignorance of life."
"You think all that of Andromaque and Phèdre, do you?" Saint Louis asked his uncle, in a faintly contemptuous tone.
"There is more truth in a single tragedy of Racine than in all the dramatic works of Monsieur Victor Hugo," replied Monsieur de Charlus. "People really are overwhelming."
Saint Louis murmured in my ear, "Preferring Racine to Victor, you may say what you like, it's epoch-making." He was genuinely distressed by his uncle's words. But the satisfaction of saying, "You may say what you like, and better still, epoch-making," consoled him. In these reflections upon the sadness of having to live apart from the person whom one loves, which were to lead my grandmother to say to me that Madame de Villeparisis's nephew understood certain things quite as well as his aunt, but in a different way, and moreover had something about him that set him far above the average clubman, Monsieur de Charlus not only allowed a refinement of feeling to appear, such as men rarely show, his voice itself, like certain contralto voices which have not been properly trained to the right pitch, so that when they sing it sounds like a duet between a young man and a woman, singing alternately, mounted when he expressed these delicate sentiments to its higher notes, took on an unexpected sweetness, and seemed to be embodying choirs of betrothed maidens, of sisters who poured out the treasures of their love. But the bevy of young girls, whom Monsieur de Charlus, in his horror of every kind of effeminacy, would have been so distressed to learn that he gave the impression of sheltering thus within his voice, did not confine themselves to the interpretation, the modulation of scraps of sentiment. Often, while Monsieur de Charlus was talking, one could hear their laughter, shrill, fresh laughter of schoolgirls or coquettes, quizzing their partners with all the archness of clever tongues and pretty wits. He told us how a house that had belonged to his family, in which Marie-Antoinette had slept, with a park laid out by Le Nôtre, was now in the hands of the Israels, the wealthy financiers who had bought it. Israel, at least that is the name these people go by, which seems to me a generic, a racial term, rather than a proper name. One cannot tell. Possibly people of that sort do not have names, and are designated only by the collective title of the tribe to which they belong. It is of no importance. But fancy, after being a home of the Guermantes, to belong to Israels? His voice rose. It reminds me of a room in the Chateau of Blois, where the caretaker who was showing me over said, "This is where Mary Stuart used to say her prayers. I used to keep my brooms in it." Naturally, I wish to know nothing more of this house that has let itself be dishonoured, any more than of my cousin, Clara de Chimay, after she left her husband. But I keep a photograph of the house when it was still unspoiled, just as I keep one of the princesse before her large eyes had learned to gaze on anyone but my cousin. A photograph acquires something of the dignity which it ordinarily lacks when it ceases to be a reproduction of reality and shows us things that no longer exist. I could give you a copy, since you are interested in that style of architecture, he said to my grandmother. At that moment, noticing that the embroidered handkerchief which he had in his pocket was showing some coloured threads, he thrust it sharply down out of sight, with the scandalised air of a prudish but far from innocent lady, concealing attractions which, by an excess of scrupulosity, she regards as indecent. "Would you believe," he went on, "that the first thing the creatures did was to destroy Le Nôtre's park, which is as bad as slashing a picture by Poussin? For that alone these Israels ought to be in prison. It is true," he added with a smile after a moment's silence, "that there are probably plenty of other reasons why they should be there. In any case, you can imagine the effect, with that architecture behind it, of an English garden." "But the house is in the same style as the Petit Trianon," said Madame de Villeparisis, "and Marie-Antoinette had an English garden laid out there."
"Which, all the same, ruins Gabrielle's front," replied Monsieur de Charlus. Obviously it would be an act of vandalism now to destroy the Amo, but whatever may be the spirit of the age, I doubt all the same whether, in that respect, a whim of Madame Israel has the same importance as the memory of the Queen.
Meanwhile, my grandmother had been making signs to me to go up to bed, in spite of the urgent appeals of Saint Lou, who, to my utter confusion, had alluded in front of Monsieur de Charlus to the depression that used often to come upon me at night before I went to sleep, which his uncle must regard as betokening a sad want of virility. I lingered a few moments still, then went upstairs, and was greatly surprised when, a little later, having heard a knock at my bedroom door and asked who was there, I heard the voice of Monsieur de Charlus saying dryly,
"It is Charlus. May I come in, sir?"
"Sir," he began again in the same tone as soon as he had shut the door,
"my nephew was saying just now that you were apt to be worried at night before going to sleep, and also that you were an admirer of Bergotte's books. As I had one here in my luggage, which you probably do not know, I have brought it to help you to while away these moments in which you are not comfortable."
I thanked Monsieur de Charlus with some warmth, and told him that, on the contrary, I had been afraid that what Saint Lou had said to him about my discomfort when night came would have made me appear in his eyes more stupid even than I was.
"No, why?" he answered in a gentler voice. "You have not, perhaps, any personal merit. So few of us have. But for a time, at least, you have youth, and that is always a charm. Besides, sir, the greatest folly of all is to laugh at or to condemn in others what one does not happen oneself to feel. I love the night, and you tell me that you are afraid of it. I love the scent of roses, and I have a friend whom it throws into a fever. Do you suppose that I think for that reason that he is inferior to me? I try to understand everything, and I take care to condemn nothing. After all, you must not be sorry for yourself. I do not say that these moods of depression are not painful. I know that one can be made to suffer by things which the world would not understand, but at least you have placed your affection wisely in your grandmother. You see a great deal of her. And besides, that is a legitimate affection. I mean one that is repaid. There are so many of which one cannot say that."
He began walking up and down the room, looking at one thing, taking up another. I had the impression that he had something to tell me, and could not find the right words to express it.
"I have another volume of Bergotte here. I will fetch it for you," he went on, and rang the bell.
Presently a page came.
"Go and find me your head waiter. He is the only person here who is capable of obeying an order intelligently," said Monsieur de Charlus stiffly.
"Monsieur Aimée, sir?" asked the page.
"I cannot tell you his name. Yes, I remember now. I did hear him called Aimée. Run along. I am in a hurry."
"He won't be a minute, sir. I saw him downstairs just now," said the page, anxious to appear efficient. There was an interval of silence. The page returned.
"Sir, Monsieur Aimée has gone to bed, but I can take your message."
"No, you have only to get him out of bed."
"But I can't do that, sir. He doesn't sleep here."
"Then you can leave us alone."
"But, sir," I said, when the page had gone, "you are too kind. One volume of Bergotte will be quite enough."
"That is just what I was thinking." Monsieur de Charlus walked up and down the room.
Several minutes passed in this way. Then, after a prolonged hesitation and several false starts, he swung sharply round, and, his voice once more stinging, flung at me,
"Good night, sir,"
and left the room.
After all the lofty sentiments which I had heard him express that evening, next day, which was the day of his departure, on the beach before noon, when I was on my way down to bathe, and Monsieur de Charlus had come across to tell me that my grandmother was waiting for me to join her as soon as I left the water, I was greatly surprised to hear him say, pinching my neck as he spoke, with a familiarity and a laugh that were frankly vulgar,
"But he doesn't give a damn for his old grandmother, does he, eh? Little rascal!"
"What, sir? I adore her!"
"Sir,"
he said, stepping back a pace, and with a glacial air,
"you are still young. You shall profit by your youth to learn two things. First, to refrain from expressing sentiments that are too natural not to be taken for granted. And secondly, not to dash into speech to reply to things that are said to you before you have penetrated their meaning. If you had taken this precaution a moment ago, you would have saved yourself the appearance of speaking at cross purposes like a deaf man, thereby adding a second absurdity to that of having anchors embroidered on your bathing dress. I have lent you a book by Bergotte which I require. See that it is brought to me within the next hour by that head waiter with the silly and inappropriate name, who, I suppose, is not in bed at this time of day. You make me see that I was premature in speaking to you last night of the charms of youth. I should have done you a better service had I pointed out to you its thoughtlessness, its inconsequence, and its want of comprehension. I hope, sir, that this little douche will be no less salutary to you than your bathe. But don't let me keep you standing. You may catch cold. Good day, sir."
No doubt he was sorry afterwards for this speech, for some time later I received, in a Morocco binding on the front of which was inlaid a panel of tooled leather representing in demi-relief a spray of forget-me-nots, the book which he had lent me, and I had sent back to him, not by Aimé, who was apparently off duty, but by the lift boy. Monsieur de Charlus having gone, Robert and I were free at last to dine with Bloch. And I realized during this little party that the stories too readily admitted by our friend as funny were favorite stories of Monsieur Bloch Senior, and that the son's really remarkable person was always one of his father's friends whom he had so classified. There are a certain number of people whom we admire in our boyhood, a father with better brains than the rest of the family, a teacher who acquires credit in our eyes from the philosophy he reveals to us, a schoolfellow more advanced than we are, which was what Bloch had been to me, who despises the Musée of the Espoir en Dieu when we still admire it, and when we have reached Lecomte or Claudel, will be in ecstasies only over "À Saint-Blaise, à la Zueca, vous étiez bien aise," with which he will include "Padoue est un fort bel endroit, où de très grands docteurs en droit, mais j'aime mieux la polenta. Passe dans mon domino noir la topatelle." And of all the nuit will remember only "Au Havre, devant l'Atlantique, à Venise, à l'Effre Lido, où vient sur l'herbe d'un tombeau mourir la pâle Adriatique." So whenever we confidently admire anyone, we collect from him, we quote with admiration sayings vastly inferior to the sort which, left to our own judgment, we would sternly reject, just as the writer of a novel puts into it, on the pretext that they are true, things which people have actually said, which in the living context are like a dead weight, form the dull part of the work. Saint-Simon's portraits, composed by himself, and very likely without his admiring them himself, are admirable. Whereas what he cites as the charming wit of his clever friends is frankly dull where it has not become meaningless. He would have scorned to invent what he reports as so pointed or so coloured when said by Madame Cornuel or Louis XIV, a point which is to be remarked also in many other writers, and is capable of various interpretations, of which it is enough to note but one for the present, namely, that in the state of mind in which we observe, we are a long way below the level to which we rise when we create.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.